Hello? Who? Hobby Lobby? It's for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's for you. Hobby Lobby, conducted by the Dean of Hobbyists, the originator of Hobby Lobby, Dave Ellman.
Thank you, Ted Brown. And greetings, friends. Welcome to Hobby Lobby. Tell me, did you ever hear of frying an egg on a cake of ice? Did you ever hear of running a steam engine with coal instead of heat? Did you ever hear of anyone using cranberries as ammunition in a gun? You will today, for on this program of Hobby Lobby, you are going to meet a woman who has made a hobby of the study of cold instead of hot. You are going to meet a man whose hobby is goats, and you're going to hear some strange American Indian songs that have come down through the ages. And you're also going to meet a man who collects paper, but not in the usual way. These are just a few of the people who have come to lobby for their hobbies on Hobby Lobby. First, a word from our announcer, and then on with the show.
Almost every family gets together from time to time for a family conference. You know the sort of thing where the members of the family exchange ideas? You may remember that last spring we had such a conference and we asked our WOR family to tell us what they thought about WOR. Well, now we'd like to take stock again. We want to have you tell us what you like and don't like about WOR's programs and services. We want to know if there is some personality you'd enjoy hearing more of, a particular show that really thrilled you, or something different about WOR that especially pleases you, and why. Now, we can't get the whole WOR family together in one place for this conference, because there are about 35 million of you, so how about telling us what you think in a letter? We'll take over from there, just as we did last spring on so many of the helpful suggestions you made. Yes, we think it's time for another family get-together, and we'd appreciate it if you'd take a few minutes and write us a letter about, well, about us here at WOR. Write to WOR, New York 18, Suggestions.
Our first hobbyist comes from Elizabeth, New Jersey. Her name is Blanche Palmer. She has one of the most dangerous hobbies in the world, and we believe she's the only woman in the world following this hobby. Miss Palmer, what is your hobby?
My hobby is experimenting with liquid air.
Will you come over here to the microphone, please? Yes, yes. Come over here to the microphone, Miss Palmer, and tell us, what is your hobby?
My hobby is experimenting with liquid air.
And what is liquid air? Many people in our audience have probably never heard of it, don't know what it is. In fact, I'm not sure that I do. Tell us, what is liquid air?
It's the same kind of air that we are breathing right now, but it has been put under such high pressure that it changes its form and becomes liquid.
And what does the liquid look like?
Exactly like water. It weighs the same, acts the same, and looks the same, but it isn't.
In its liquid form, is it hot or cold?
Cold. 365 degrees below zero.
And that is some cold. Miss Palmer, how much air is there in this little pint vacuum container? Do you happen to know?
There is as much air in this tiny little container as there is in the entire studio.
Think of that, as much air in that little bottle as there is in this whole big theater. And you have some of that cold stuff right there?
Oh, yes, but it isn't a bottle. A bottle wouldn't hold it, Dave. It's a special vacuum container, chemically treated, that I've made, especially for the use of holding liquid air.
Well, Miss Palmer, what kind of experiments do you do with liquid air?
Here's one of them, Dave.
Yes?
I have some cranberries in this little, ordinary cranberries in this little glass. I'm going to shake them. They're practically noiseless, but maybe you can hear them over the air. Now I'm going to pour some liquid into them.
That hissing sound you hear is the liquid air being poured onto the cranberries. Now, after treating these cranberries with liquid air for just a few seconds, now listen to them. Frozen hard as marble in just a few seconds.
Yes. Yes, they're frozen so hard that I can actually use these cranberries for ammunition in a gun.
Well, Miss Palmer, what else can you do with liquid air?
Here's a little steam engine. And steam has to be over 212 degrees Fahrenheit to run this engine. Now I'm going to try running the engine with liquid air 365 degrees below zero.
Well, she takes up the vacuum can of the liquid air and starts pouring the liquid air into the steam engine, the compartment that would ordinarily hold the water. And now she puts a cork over it, and now there's the engine running on cold instead of heat. It's all right. Just turn it. Can't turn it off, huh? Okay.
Not very well. It's
Take
frozen.
Your time. That's right. And some of that liquid air went all over us. Well, now, just a couple more questions, Miss Palmer. How long have you been working at your hobby?
Since 1916.
Well, is liquid air injurious?
Oh, yes. Liquid air is so cold that it can give you a third-degree burn in less time than it takes to tell it.
Wait a minute. Did you say a third-degree burn?
Oh, yes. I can fry eggs with liquid air, Dave. Would you like to see me do it?
You can fry eggs with liquid air?
I certainly can.
And well, now, let's see how you fry eggs with liquid air.
All right.
Friends, she has a frying pan, a skillet in one hand, an egg in the other. Now, she takes the can of liquid air. Now, she breaks the egg right over it. I think we better come over here so that we can have the sound. Now, the liquid air is being poured right in to the skillet of ice. Remember, the skillet is on a cake of ice. Listen to it sizzle. It is being frozen with cold instead of heat. And now, we'll have a 3-minute egg in about 30 seconds, I think. And there it is. There you are. I noticed that you have some grapes there. What do you do with the grapes?
Well, this is an experiment in sound, Dave. I place 2 grapes on the end of these prongs.
And so saying, she does. She's taking off 2 grapes from the bunch. Now she puts a grape on each end of the prong. And now what are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to sound off on the chimes, and I think you'll find that they are absolutely noiseless.
They're almost noiseless.
That's right. And now I'm going to take
2
grapes, place them in my container of liquid air, and in just a moment...
She is taking the grapes... And now she's pouring liquid air over the grapes. You should be able to hear the sizzle of the liquid air onto the grapes. It takes a little while longer, I understand.
Oh, yes,
to freeze grapes than it does cranberries. But in just a little while now, she's already used up 1 container of liquid air. Now she's on the second one, which means she's already used twice the amount of air that we have in this entire theater.
You're quite right.
And now, as the grapes freeze, they are on the ends of the prongs, remember that. And I believe they're almost frozen. Are they frozen?
Ready. Yes, they're ready, Dave.
All right, now let's hear them on the chime. Miss Palmer, tell us, what is the most sensational experiment you've been able to perform with liquid air?
Well, Mr. Ellman, for a long time, scientists have been working on a theory of suspended animation. Some of them believe that in time they will be able to freeze a man instantly and bring him back to life 1,000 years later.
Well, do you think there's anything to that theory?
Well, I don't know. But I do know that I can take a goldfish out of the water, freeze it solid with liquid air, in other words, suspend the life of the fish, and then bring it back to life completely unharmed in any way.
You mean you could do that here and now if we gave you enough time?
Yes, Mr. Ellman, I can.
Well, we're going to take the time to have you do this demonstration... thoroughly. Freeze the fish solidly and then bring it back to life. Friends, I believe that this is the first time on the air that such a demonstration has ever been attempted. Miss Palmer is now reaching for the goldfish with a little net. She has it in the net. Now she has a little skillet, what looks like a tiny skillet, and she puts the goldfish into the skillet. It is now in the skillet. That, of course, makes no sound. A goldfish never did make a sound at all.
Not as yet.
And now she's pouring plenty of liquid air over the goldfish. Take plenty of time for this demonstration.
Oh, I am.
Plenty of time.
It takes a few moments longer.
To freeze that fish solid, take a little bit more time, please. A little bit more time. That's right. And now we have some more liquid air on it. And now those fish are frozen solid to the bottom of that skillet. And now try to bring them back to life by putting them in the warmer water, which will revive them, we hope. There they are. Around as good as ever. Thank you, Miss Blanche Palmer.
Thank you. Our next guest on Hobby Lobby is a young Pawnee Indian, grandson of the famous American Indian Chief White Eagle. His name is Ralph Allen, known to his own people as Lone Bear. Lone Bear, tell us, what is your hobby?
collecting early American Indian songs.
Tell us about one, Lone Bear.
Well, every Indian brave composes his own special love song for the girl he is serenading. She never forgets that song. After they are married and a little papoose comes along, she changes the words of her serenade and turns it into a lullaby.
You mean she hushes all her children to sleep with a love song that was the serenade of her courtship days?
Yes, Mr. Elman.
Well, what becomes of the original love song?
It's forgotten. That's why lullabies live and love songs die.
Well, Lone Bear, will you sing an Indian lullaby for us?
Yes, Mr. Elman. The mother tells her little boy that someday he will be a brave man like his father and serenade a beautiful Indian maiden with a love song of his own.
Now I eat a six a
Friends, you've just heard an Indian lullaby, a truly authentic Indian lullaby, once an Indian serenade.
Yes, but the song of the medicine man is more exciting. This song is supposed to drive evil spirits out of a sick man's body.
Well, Lone Bear, suppose you give us some big medicine, will you?
All right, but I'll leave it to you if after hearing it, a patient ever recovers.
Thank you, Lone Bear. Friends, we'll continue with Hobby Lobby after this brief announcement.
Have you ever read a newspaper criticism of a show or a radio program and said, "Oh boy, what I'd say about that program if I had a chance"? Well, we'll be happy to give you the chance to be a critic about some radio program. Frequently, you'll find a group of critical radio listeners in one of our theaters deep in a discussion of the merits and demerits of some radio program. Now, these audience reaction sessions are mighty stimulating, and we'd like to have you join one. Any afternoon, we'd like to join. And bring your friends, too. You can all turn radio critics for the afternoon. Here's how you go about getting to be a critic. Write a note. A penny postcard will do to Audience Reaction, WOR New York 18. Just say that you'd like tickets to one of our afternoon audience reaction sessions. Tell us how many tickets you'd like, and don't be bashful. They're free. Audience Reaction, WOR New York 18, New York.
Our guest of honor is Homer Croy, the man who wrote more of the late Will Rogers motion picture stories than any other person. Welcome to Hobby Lobby, Homer Croy. Homer, you've written innumerable books. You wrote 16 Hands and Country Cure, and I've just heard about your newest movie, Family Honeymoon, starring Claudette Colbert and Fred McMurray, and here's wishing you every good wish for the new picture.
Okay.
And now, Homer, tell us, what is your hobby?
Well, it's collecting and using other people's stationery.
Why do you do it?
Well, to give my friends a laugh.
Is that the only purpose?
Well, that's the purpose now, but that wasn't the way it started. Oh, no.
Well, let's go back to the beginning then, Homer.
Well, when I first came to New York, I was a struggling young writer just like 10,000 other people around town. And things got so bad for me, I couldn't afford writing paper. And I couldn't let the folks back home know how, well, indefinite my address was.
Naturally. So what did you do about it?
Well, I'd go into the Waldorf Astoria or the Astor Hotel and into the writing room, and I'd get a sheet or two of the hotel's engraved stationery, and then I'd write my letter home on that. And then at the bottom of the letter, I'd put Oh, P.S. Temporary address, 22 Bowery. Or whatever it was happened to be that particular week where I was staying. Also, I needed paper to write my manuscripts on.
Yeah, but hotel stationery is usually small. You couldn't use that for manuscripts, could you?
Oh, no, I didn't. I used office stationery for that.
Well, how'd you get the office stationery?
Oh, when I was going around hunting jobs.
Well, after you arrived in New York, you finally did succeed in selling a story. What paper did you write that on?
The back of business stationery that I'd picked up while I was looking for work.
Well, wasn't it kind of daring to send a story into an editor on that kind of paper?
Well, yes, it was in a way, but I found afterward it attracted more attention in the office and the editorial rooms than anything else that I'd done. Well, to be specific about that, I sold a short story to Theodore Dreiser. He was then editor of some women's magazines about his publications.
Well, that was one way of turning a liability into an asset, wasn't it?
Well, for that reason, I began collecting stationery then and kept it up, and I'm still doing it. It's given my friends, it's a million laughs, and I have some friends who even exchange my letters among themselves.
Homer, it's said that no one can identify a letter from you until the envelope is opened. Is that true?
Yes, that's the idea. For instance, the envelope and the return address on the envelope is from a tombstone maker. And then, lo and behold, when you open it up, the letter is written on the stationery from the office of a musical comedy producer.
What's the most unusual piece of writing paper you ever used?
Well, one time I was very anxious to consummate a deal, and I tore the backing off of a porous plaster, a mustard plaster, you know, and wrote it on the backing of this mustard plaster and got my job.
Well, how do you collect your writing paper? Do you do it all yourself?
Oh, no, I have friends who send it in to me from all over the world. I have had the stuff, stationery, sent to me from India, even.
Well, by this time, you must be a connoisseur of writing paper.
Well, I think I am. When I first started out, I just took the easy kinds that anybody get from hotels and steamships and sort of things like that. Then after a while, the wind got in my nostrils, and I began collecting the unusual and the bizarre and the striking.
Well, give me an example of what you consider bizarre writing paper.
Well, not long ago, I honored a friend with a letter written on the stationery that came from a Turkish harem.
True. How about some unusual stationery?
Well, I gave my friends a laugh while back by writing on the stationery of a bill collector.
And now what about the striking stationery?
Well, I have a friend sent me some from stationery from Skagway, Alaska. It was a boarding house stationery, and the top of it read Soapy Smith Place, and there was the old date line. It said Skagway, Alaska, 1890, and the last figure was blank to be filled in with whatever it happened to be. When I used it, I dated it, for instance, the 3rd of March, 1898, and then down at the bottom I wrote Homer Croy, successor to Soapy Smith.
Well, yeah. Homer, are you still collecting stationery even now?
Oh, yes, yes. I work at it every day.
You do? You mean you collected some today?
I did.
Where'd you get some today?
I did. Up in your office, Dave, when I was up there. Here it is. Hobby Lobby program.
Well, thanks.
I forgot.
Well, thank you, Homer Croy. Here's hoping that your new movie is a big success, and thank you for lobbying for your hobby. Mr. Adolph Bruner of New York City is a watch salesman. He travels all around New England and during his travels has time for a very interesting hobby. What is your hobby, Mr. Bruner?
I collect spoons.
Well, with many people, that's a habit, not a hobby. Where do you get your spoons?
I search through jeweler's scrap heaps for rare and unusual souvenir spoons.
You mean when you call on a jeweler to sell him watches, he sells you spoons?
Yes. When I went into a jewelry store, I was both a salesman and a prospective customer.
Well, Mr. Bruner, how'd you happen to start that hobby?
Well, Mr. Ellman, did you ever hear of the Iron Maiden of Nuremberg?
You mean that famous spike torture chamber, the outside of which looked like a beautiful woman, but the inside was a mass of spikes which would slowly pierce the victim's body as the doors of the torture chamber closed upon him?
That's the one. Well, this spoon that started me on my hobby is a relic of the days when men tortured each other.
How in the world did you get hold of it?
I happened to see a heap of old scrap silver in one of my customers' stores, and I spied a very unusual-looking spoon in these discards. On closer examination, I found that this spoon had tiny doors in the handle, and when I opened those doors, I found a replica of a spiked torture chamber. I was holding in my hands a souvenir representation of that Iron Maiden.
What are some other interesting spoons in your collection? What are some other interesting spoons?
Here's a delicate little spoon I picked up. When it is held up to the light, the handle resembles a beautiful stained glass cathedral window. This type of enamel work was originally done at the time of the Tsars and has since become a lost art. It's a relic of Holy Russia when religion was the dominating force. It's a souvenir of days that will never come again.
Well, that spoon must be very valuable.
It is now, but I bought it from a discard pile for only 20 cents. And here's a spoon that cost me a dollar, and in return, I received a spoon and 50 cents.
Wait, Mr. Bruner, I think you'll have to explain that.
The top of the handle is a silver seal of the United States.
Well, where does the 50 cents come in?
A pressed half dollar is the bowl of the spoon.
Well, you do find bargains. Mr. Bruner, you have many beautiful and unusual spoons in your collection, but most of them don't seem to be very practical, as we know spoons.
Well, here's one that is. It's a souvenir from Holland. In the bowl of the spoon is a Dutch water scene, and on the handle is a miniature Dutch windmill. And the windmill actually spins around. I would say that this is the most practical in my collection.
Well, how's that?
The windmill could be cooling your coffee while you were stirring it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Adolf Bruner. Anthony Ippolito is an architect from New Jersey. When he isn't at work, he spends his spare time at... Well, what is your hobby, Tony?
Collecting spoons.
No, wait a minute. The hobbyist who just finished talking about it does that.
But another fellow can have the same hobby, can't he? Besides,
yes,
I have more spoons than he has.
Well, how many spoons have you collected?
Over 600.
Oh, that sounds like the same hobby to me, Tony.
But it isn't. I collect my spoons for an entirely different reason.
Well, what other reason could a person possibly be...
I play tunes on my spoons.
You mean you make music on them?
Well, opinion differ on that. But my wife and I enjoy it.
Well, supposing you serve up a spoon solo, or should I say, ladle out a lullaby. Go ahead, Tony. Friends, we're going to bring you a great human interest story after this short announcement.
At night, how often have you tiptoed into your child's room to make sure that he's still covered up? And how many times do you find that he's kicked the covers off? Well, you don't mind that, because you don't mind if he's restless. Rather, you're thankful that he's healthy and active. Well, some kids aren't that lucky. Your National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, supported by the March of Dimes, is helping many of these children, regardless of age, color, race, or creed, who can't afford to pay the cost of medical treatment. Your National Foundation is helping them get back on their feet. It needs your help. Yes, it needs your help now through the March of Dimes to continue medical care and therapy for them. Now, you must help these children walk again. Here's what you can do. Send your dimes and dollars to your local March of Dimes headquarters. Fight infantile paralysis. Join the March of Dimes. Don't put it off until tomorrow. Pitch in. Be generous. Help fight polio by giving all you can to the March of Dimes.
The mayor of Randolph Township in New Jersey is on our program now. His name is Robert Crowley, and he's here to lobby for his hobby. Bob, what is your hobby?
Goats.
Goats? Well, how did a man in your position get tangled up with goats?
Because of my baby.
Your baby?
Yes. The youngest of five. When he was born, we couldn't find the proper food for him. He kept losing weight. For 6 weeks, he cried night and day. A baby specialist tried every type of food. Nothing was any good until our old kindly family doctor in Kansas City, where we were living at that time, suggested goat's milk. He said babies could sometimes keep that down when everything else failed. So I started out on a hunt for goat's milk. I couldn't find a goat anywhere. Finally, I located a preacher on the outskirts of town who owned a few. He let me have some milk, and the baby was saved. He slept well, gained weight, and rewarded us with a smile. Then I was scared sick. What if our supply of goat's milk was cut off? That made me buy a goat.
And that was the start of your hobby?
Yes, and then I got another goat. And soon we had more milk and goats than we knew what to do with. My wife conceived the idea of giving the surplus milk to the kids at the orphanage who needed goat's milk. Soon we were supplying 5 hospitals and the babies an endless. First thing we knew, our hobby developed into a real modern goat dairy. Mrs. Crowley's Grade A goat milk has done a lot for the children of Kansas City.
Well, how many goats do you have in all right now?
We had 75 last week, but 10 arrived over the weekend, and I called home tonight, and 10 arrived today.
Well, congratulations. I suppose, since that experience with your baby, you regard goat's milk as one of life's essentials.
I certainly do. I don't call it a cure-all, Dave. You'll have to consult your doctor about that. But we regard our dairy as a monument to the goat that saved our baby's life.
Well, thank you, Bob Crowley, for lobbying for your hobby. Friends, when I first arrived in New York City many years ago, one of the first people I met was a young man named Fred Hall, and we've been friends ever since. Well, tonight I have the pleasure of inviting Fred to lobby for his hobby. I know that for many years his hobby has been nostalgic tricks at the piano. Fred, how'd you ever get interested in that hobby?
Well, Dave, ever since I was a kid, I always liked the older things. I never went for the popular songs of the day. I always liked the old-timers and that sort of thing, and that's the reason that things like the pianola sort of linger with me. Remember the old play a piano, you know, where you wore your legs out on a Saturday night at the house party? Remember?
Suppose you give us your impression of a pianola.
Well, they always invited this bird over. Nobody ever put the rolls back in the right boxes. You know, you pull out Dardanella and Sweet Rosie O'Grady and come out on it. And if you remember well enough, it sounded something like this. Got to set it at 80, if you remember. Stop. Where's the re-roll, Dave? Oh, here it is.
Fred, give us quickly one more of your tricks at the piano.
Well, the only little thing, as I say, I always liked old songs, so I finally made a little specialty of hillbilly songs because it's the oldest form of American music, as you know. Maybe we've got time for a verse of 11 more months, do you think?
Oh, no, Fred. Time's up.